Hi, this is Ryan Dawson of the Anti-Neocon Report, ancreport.com. Lovely name, I got that way back in the day. And with me tonight, or today, depending on your time zone, is a great guest, Greg Felton. He wrote several books. One we're going to be talking about tonight is The Host and the Parasite, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America. He also has a great book before that called Exploding Middle East Myths, which we'll probably touch on. We're going to touch on topics in both of these books. But The Host and the Parasite is the one I want to get into the most. But first, Greg, how are you? How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing fine. Right now it's 8:35 in the morning, Saturday. So I'm a little behind you.
Are you in Canada?
Yeah, I'm the west coast of Canada.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just kidding. Sorry. West coast of Canada. Well, yeah. You do live under Trudeau, no homo.
Sadly.
Harper was just as bad. So, better than my governments.
that's probably true. However, Stephen Harper was a bona fide fascist, and I proved that he was actually fascist, not even conservative. But Justin Trudeau is such a spineless little pretty boy mannequin that he's little more than a sock puppet for corporate interests in Israel. I mean, he's not Stephen Harper, that's true, but he's what I call Harper Jr. Mm-hmm. He's like a man who doesn't have the courage to undo the damage his predecessor did. And we're now saddled with a image-seeking identity politics schmuck, and he's an embarrassment, frankly.
I feel but sorry for you.
Yeah, but you look at someone like...
We wanted to start a movement for Canada, like the MAGA thing, except it's going to call it MICMA, Make Canada Mediocre Again, but with Trudeau. We thought with Trudeau that would be a reasonable goal, but now the highlights are Trailer Park Boys and Vikings, so... But no, I'm kidding. you're a linguist by trade as well. And
That's right.
I want to pick your brain on that because I think a lot of this discussion about Israel-Palestine... Well, first of all, I don't like how it always gets reduced down to Israel-Palestine. It's really, for American and Canadian point of view, it's why there's a war in Iraq, why there was a war in Libya, why there's a war in Syria, why there's sanctions on Iran. It's way beyond Palestine, but it usually gets drizzled down to that. But we can't talk about any of these topics without a whole bunch of hurdles in the language. When it's certain terms you want to use, you want to say, it's almost you have to pump the brakes and explain what you mean all the time. And one of the things that that eats me all the time is people are like, name the Jew, say Jew, don't say Zionist. I'm like, no, because they're not the same thing at all. One's an ethnic group, one's a political ideology. I wonder your thoughts on breaking that down, and have you also come across the same sort of rhetoric where if you criticize Zionism, people think you hate Jews in general and blah, blah, blah?
Oh, yes, I've had that a lot. First of all, the term Jew is not an ethnic determination. Jew is a religious term. Uh-huh. I mean, you can have Hungarian Jews, you can have Russian Jews, French Jews, you can even have Iraqi and Palestinian Jews. The only people who ever considered Jews to be an ethnic group were Nazis and Zionists, which is not surprising because they're both products of the same tree of fascism. And one of the problems with a lot of Jews is that they refuse to acknowledge the kinship between people like Adolf Hitler and David Ben-Gurion, Menachem Begin, or Yitzhak Rabin and Benjamin Netanyahu. They are all essentially the same kind of person. But what's happened is our minds have been essentially hijacked. We have been given a false dichotomy between the victimized Jew and the victimizing German. And that quasi-religious mindset is almost impervious to analysis. Because the minute you try to do that, you're seen as giving credence to the other side. You're seen as being supportive of the enemy's position. Which reminds me of Aristotle's famous saying that the sign of a mature person is someone who can hold an idea in his mind without necessarily believing it. So you can entertain thoughts and discuss them, but it doesn't mean that you're going to endorse them. And this is one of the tragedies of the modern world. Our language is enslaving us. And I want to give you a good example of this, and that's the term anti-Semitism. That term dates from 1873, and it was invented by a man named Wilhelm Marr, who was a virulent anti-German polemicist. And he came up with the term anti-Semitism because he wanted a term to categorize Jews in a way that wasn't wholly religious. Now, you can't persecute people based on religion because it makes you look like a small, petty little fool. And besides which, religion is kind of hard to go after someone for. It's a very personal thing. So with the term Semitism, which is essentially a nonsense term because it's a linguistic term, it comes from the Hebrew letter Shem in the alphabet, and it's people who have a certain sound in their language. So there's the word Sem and Shem in Hebrew. So that means that's a Semitic language. It's Semitic the same way Arabic is Semitic, or Aramaic was Semitic, or Coptic. There's a whole family of Semitic languages. So it's not an ethnic term at all. And yet this horrible expression has been sanctified by the propaganda arm of Israel and its lobbyists all over the world. So the minute you criticize Israel, you're deemed to be an anti-Semite. Even the term, though the term has no intellectual foundation, it's a phony word. And this is probably the one thing people have to stop allowing themselves to do, is be intimidated by that term. It's like calling you a bad person, or you're the devil's spawn, or something silly like that.
Do you think that atheist Jew is an oxymoron then?
No, I don't think so. I mean, a lot of the Jews that founded Israel, from Ben Gurion to Yosef Weitz, Menachem Begin, Yitzhak Yizernitsky, who became Yitzhak Shamir, these were all non-believing Jews. And they persecuted European believing Jews because they thought them to be backsliding traitors to their religion, because they were content to live in countries run by Christians. I mean, the Jews that wanted to live under Christian rule in Europe were thought to be less Jewish than those who wanted to leave Europe for Palestine and to dispossess the local population there. So this is the great failure of much of our history, is that we have failed to distinguish the Yiddish Jew, which is the standard Jew that we think of when we think of Hollywood or Borscht Belt comics or movie producers, and the Zionist Jew, which is a neo-fascist, atheistic Jew who wants to, who has a, I don't know how to put it, a political agenda, not a religious one. And these are the people that have made Israel illegally and unethically, and have essentially browbeaten the vast majority of Jews around the world into supporting them. But in fact, most don't.
I would say they're about half atheists. They may have gotten rid of some of the more fantastical parts of the religion, with Moses and parting the Red Sea and some of the miracles and things, but they still retain a sort of racial claim to land, that God gave it to his people, and we're his people through bloodline to Jacob or whatever. And so that's, they right, haven't completely done away with the religion. They just sort of secularized it, but still, yeah, they're dogmatic enough to have God as a real estate agent and take right, this land, even right, if they don't believe in God, which is weird. It means it's just a cover for their own greediness and so forth. And then you have to admit, too, there are a lot of religious Zionists as well. I mean, the settlers are completely fanatics.
But they're psychopathic. They're psychopathic, yeah.
Yeah, they're like the Nazis. Psychopaths.
Yeah, they're like the Nazis in World War II. In Germany, they love to persecute the pop. The Nazis persecuted Jews. Let's face it, it's true. And just as the Nazis persecuted Jews, Jews are persecuting Palestinians. And this is the great parallel between Nazis and Jews, Zionist Jews, is the great unspoken truth of the modern age. Because once you do that, once you expose that link, then everything of Israel comes crashing down about your ears. The myth of the Holocaust, the institutionalization of world guilt for something that was essentially created by Zionist Jews. You know, it's funny thing about the Zionists. You see, by the time Hitler comes to power in 1933, Germany is on its last legs. Economically, it's a basket case. And
that, the boycott would have worked.
The boycott was working brilliantly. The international world boycott against Germany, led by Jewish veterans of World War I, was having a great effect. But you see, one second. In a meeting with Hermann Göring in early 1933, I think it was March, he called in the leaders of all the Jewish communities, and he read them the Riot Act. I mean, you better stop this propaganda against the Germany. You have to behave. You have to get in line. Blah blah. He was just ranting. But one person who was not invited to that meeting was a man named Kurt Blumenfeld, who was the head of the American Zionist Jews. Sorry, the German Zionist Jews. Which was only about 1-2% of the German Jewish population. Yet it was the Zionists who actively sabotaged anti-German propaganda and made it possible for Hitler to trade throughout the world through something called the Transfer Agreement, which, if you haven't read, is a fascinating story of Jewish betrayal of their own people to serve the Nazis, because the Nazis and the Zionists had the same objective.
I think it's Edwin Black has a book about the Havara Agreement.
That is right, and I'll tell you a story about Edwin Black in just a minute. See, the Germans, the Nazis and the Zionists had the same objective, that was to rid Europe of its Jewish population. The Nazis couldn't have cared less what happened to them. They could have died, they could have emigrated, no big deal, just get rid of them. The Zionists were a little bit more picky. They wanted them to leave, but only to Palestine. Any Jew who did not go to Palestine was a Jew lost to the Zionist experiment. And to that end, the Zionists actively sabotaged Jews who were trying to flee Nazi persecution. It was the Zionist Jews that made the concentration camps possible. And that is something that a lot of people will not face up to and cannot talk about. Because without the Zionists, there would have been no concentration camps.
Well, not only Jews trying to flee Germany, they attacked and killed Jews who were fleeing Palestine. The SS Patria is a great example. They sank a ship with over 1,000 Jews on it and 55 British sailors that was leaving Palestine to go to Mauritania. They didn't want them to leave. So rather than let them leave, they'd risk killing them. And they did kill many of them. And ironically, those that were rescued got rescued by Palestinian fishermen. But that's the attitude of like a Ben Gurion. Wasn't he the one in 35 that said something along the lines of if he could save all the children, Jewish children in Germany, he would rather have half of them die if it meant that the other half went to Palestine?
That's right. He said that in 1935.
Sick.
Yes, he did. Nice, good history. Well done. You know your history. Ben-Gurion actively knew what he was doing. And later on, he told Nahum Goldman, who would later become head of the World Jewish Congress, that we should not heap scorn on the Palestinians. We came and stole their land. They are defending themselves. We should understand them. We are the invaders. The Zionists were Jewish Nazis. They were Jewish fascists. They were horrible, nasty people, and they still are. But they had the interesting fact of being very honest about what they were doing and what they were trying to do. And if you look at the words of the Zionist Jews, you can see great statements that if anybody had any interest, they could use against Israel anytime they wanted. Because it was the Zionists who made possible who are the best sources for anti-Zionist propaganda. It is truly an amazing fact. But they get away with it though, because they know that nobody will do anything about it. It's the height of hubris.
Oh, we can never forgive the Arabs for forcing us to kill their children.
Oh yes, that's horrible.
And that's right out of the lips of an Israeli prime minister. And the things they say, and you don't even have to go way back or anything. I mean, only one Israeli prime minister was actually born in Israel. All the rest are migrants. But even in modern times, Netanyahu, when they just passed their official apartheid decree, is saying that this is a Jewish state for Jewish people. They've got color-coded license plates, you know, for the self-proclaimed chosen race of God, segregated high schools, rules against, you know, interracial marriage, etc.
Yeah.
And it goes on, and it's confusing to me because the left seems to have almost hyperactive sensitivity to any kind of racism or prejudice, if it's whites that are doing it. And yet, if it's in Palestine, it just doesn't matter. And it, do you think it's the guilt of the Holocaust being used to get leftists to cower before the fear of being labeled anti-Semitic? Because these tend to be really scared of also being labeled prejudiced, go out of their way to the point where now there's, I don't know, like 50 genders or something because the cry bullies have them so cowered in a corner.
That is so true. You're spot on. The Holocaust was a fabricated propaganda ploy. But the far left is so hypersensitive to offending anybody that they go out of their way to be silly. I mean, they will not denounce something for being false lest they give offense to the person making the false claim. Now, that might sound ridiculous. I mean, our whole court system is designed to punish people who do things wrong. Yet, for the radical left, the squishy left, it's impermissible. Now, I had an experience. I'm writing about this right now, and I hope to have this finished in a week. I gave a speech here in my local town of Port Coquitlam at a local bookstore, and I was asked to speak after I mentioned that I was a local author. And I gave a talk about my book, The Host and the Parasite, which you can get, by the way, at thehostandtheparasite.com, which we'll talk a bit about later. And I think I mentioned the word Jew only once, and I meant it in the sense that a lot of Christians, a lot of so-called Gentiles, love to be associated with very wealthy Jews. There's a certain Judeophilia that goes with being a very influential Christian, and we know this because it happened in England with Josiah Wedgwood, he of the pottery fame, and he was very much a Philo-Semite or Judeophile. And a lot of the British at the time were staunchly in favor of carving out a Jewish state in the Middle East. They had no rational reason for it. They just liked the Jews. They felt a kinship to them, as if they were part of the Bible and, you know, the Arabs were some sort of other person. At any rate, I mentioned this just once, and I didn't mean it in any pejorative sense. I meant it simply as a fact of history. Anyway, I get an email the next day or day after saying that the owner of the store talked with your partner and said, well, unfortunately, we cannot carry your book because you attacked people for their faith. I said, what? I have been scrupulous throughout my writing to separate Zionists from Jews. As a matter of fact, I've written at least three articles that bring up Jews persecuted by Zionists here in Canada. And I tried to explain to this woman that you had no right to insult me like that or to refuse to carry my book. And she was completely unmoved. She would not change her mind. She would not back down from anything she said, even though she admitted that she put words in my mouth and made me say things I never did. But this woman is a super tolerant, hypersensitive, I think she's also Jewish. Her last name is Gori.
The intolerance of super tolerance. It's a great badge of honor to find an anti-Semite or any kind of racist so that you can browbeat him and be like, oh, what a good boy am I. I accused somebody of sexism, racism, xenophobia, whatever. Finding isms is like, it's part of the victim Olympics. And
oh yeah,
that's what gives them a sense of self-satisfaction. And I think a lot of these people probably harbor prejudices that they're trying to get over, that they know are not socially acceptable, but privately, that's what they believe. And so one way of dealing with that is to, you know, point and say someone else is a witch, so it shifts that blame and guilt off of themselves and onto someone else.
I think there's also something else that's important. Is that if people believe something for a great many years and it becomes part of their belief system, it becomes very difficult, if not impossible, for them to analyze that belief system logically. Because if you do that, if they try to do that, they might come up to a horrible realization that for much of their life they had been dead wrong. And this would probably be something that would be too painful for them to admit. So for many people, I think it's a case of having to perpetuate the lie for the sake of defending their own sense of self. The French philosopher Émile Durkheim wrote about something called ego suicide. Now, I don't know whether this would apply entirely to these people, but if you have a sense of self and it's built on a foundation, in this case, of Jewish victimhood and the cult of the Holocaust and defending Jews come what may, then if you find that to be basically fraudulent, then you have to ask yourself, what have you believed all this time? And I think a lot of people are simply afraid to face up to the fallacies of their own beliefs. And I just don't think people... You try to have an intelligent conversation with anybody, Jew or non-Jew, about the Holocaust. I put a little registered trademark next to it whenever I use it because it's been appropriated by Jews.
Well, that's another language thing when you say the Holocaust. First of all, there have been many death by fire, if that's what you mean by Holocaust. I mean, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were Holocaust.
No, not exactly. In the case of 6 million dead or dying Jews... that term had been around since before World War II. As a matter of fact, on Halloween 1918, a publication called The American Hebrew ran a piece by a former New York governor who talked about 6 million dead or dying Romanian Jews. The New York Times in 1935 wrote about 6 million dead or dying Jews.
Yes, and that's where this number comes from. It's during World War One and even before, it's in newspapers of the coming 6 million. It fulfills a prophecy, so they want it to be the number that fits with their religious dogma.
Exactly.
But even in Holocaust scholars don't say 6 million. That's more of the like second grade version of history you get from the same people that tell you what a great guy Columbus was, that he was trying to prove the earth was round or something. But serious historians are like, that doesn't mean there's zero dead, but it just means not 6 million doesn't mean zero. But it's always A or B with people like, oh, you're in full denial of anybody dying, which would also be ridiculous. People definitely died in labor camps. Even if you don't believe in gassings, you have to admit that people starved to death, died of typhus and disease and were worked to death, shot, etc. Mm-hmm. It's horrible no matter what your number is. But it's got nothing to do with Palestine. And why are they being punished and colonized for what Nazis did?
Well, that's what H.G. Wells said. H.G. Wells says the UN had no right to take land from one person and give it to another. It is not in the purview of the United Nations Charter to be a land agent.
And well, they did have a condition that they would allow right of return, which they accepted, and then, of course, didn't do it.
No. But I've got a picture from the New York Times from June 11th, 1900. And what we have here is Zionist leaders and movement aroused enthusiasm in Cooper Union in New York. And there's 6 million Jews. The 5 million brethren who are suffering oppression, actually 5 million here. It's kind of, they kind of cut back. This is Dr. Gottheil's work. This is Rabbi Stephen Weiss, who is one of the most notorious Zionist Jews, who was very much responsible for sabotaging the anti-German boycott. There's appeal, 1914, appeal for aid for Jews, New York Times, December 2nd. Apply to more than 6 million Jews. We don't know where they come from, but there's 6 million of them. There are 6 million Jews at the heart. Here's another one from New York Times, January 14th, 1915. This is Galicia. This is in Poland and in Russia. 6 million are in the very heart of the war zone. I mean, the whole cult of 6 million had been launched long before Hitler came to power. And this goes through a piece of eccentric, non-standard Hebraic mythology, which said that 6 million Jews had to die a fiery death before Jews could return to the Holy Land. And so this cult of 6 million was long and underway before Hitler came to power, but you can't tell that to anybody because they don't want to hear it.
You legally cannot tell that to people in some places. I have a video showing all these newspapers and things that you were reading back. My audience is red-pilled to that already, so don't worry about that. But it's important to point out, though, that it doesn't matter if it's 6 million or 1 million or whatever. Like, what happened was horrible, and Zionists helped perpetuate this. Zionists actually wanted the Germans to ally with them in their war against Britain. You know, and I'm not favoring British colonialism either. I'm not saying there are any good guys in World War II. But you can't have a nuanced point of view legally in many European states, and some cases in Canada too. If they can't get you on that, they'll find some other excuse. They firebombed Ernst Zundel's house. People will go after you.
That's
just
right.
For your historical opinion, which I think is ridiculous.
See, you can tell someone is a coward when they intimidate a point of view. They intimidate people. They refuse to allow discussion, which is why, I think I may have mentioned this before, not here but elsewhere, the Holocaust did not happen historically. It happened religiously. It is an act of sacred violence that, once propagated, can never be taken back. Because acts of sacred violence are the foundations upon which religions, dogmas, and power structures are built. In the case, for example, of the September the 11th, 2001, those buildings came down not because of any aircraft or any Arabs, because it was done by Israel. And their agents in Washington, what I call the Bush Junta, in Chapter 11 of my book. Because once you look at the history of the fall of the World Trade Centers, it's obvious it wasn't done by aircraft. It can be proven physically. It's not debatable. It's absolutely true.
Well, they found vans with explosive devices in the World Trade Center in the basements, and then the same moving companies were busted with not only an Israeli front company, but Israelis, just two of five that were initially arrested because they were witnessed celebrating the attacks, were already on the counterterrorism database, Sivan Kirsberg and Paul Kirsberg, who admitted in his FBI interrogation that the Jewish agency had sent him there. The board of governors director for that is Ertime Wertheimer, the richest man in Israel, who also gave Bernard Kerik a $250,000 loan through intermediaries, who is the police commissioner, who then dismisses that they found explosives. So it's this long story, and my audience is red-pilled to that as well. I mean, Israeli agents were literally caught celebrating the attacks. Zeid Al-Jarrah, who's the alleged pilot for Flight 93, he had two first cousins busted in Lebanon just months after 9/11 as Israeli spies, as well as an uncle who was a liaison spying on the PLO. Now, that is something. A 9/11 hijacker has first cousins and an uncle who are not just Israeli, but Israeli agents for a foreign intelligence agency. And so when you put that all together, there's no doubt. I mean, it goes on the anthrax notes, death to America, death to Israel, and James Woolsey comes back saying that, oh yeah, Mohammed Atta got anthrax from senior Iraqi officials in Prague. And there is no meeting in Prague, and there is no transfer of anthrax. But in Blid, Le Mans, New York Observer, they all said that Israeli security forces witnessed this transfer. Well, the Israeli security forces lied. And then Fred Barnes and all the Weekly Standard people from PNAT, William Crystal, Gary Schmidt, etc., they all reiterate this anthrax lie. Israel's literally on the notes, you know, and it ended up being traced back to U.S.'s own labs. So it didn't matter. We were bombing Iraq by then anyway.
Yeah, this is the great lie of a religion, is that you have to perpetuate the lie regardless of what evidence is brought up. And the more accurate the evidence, the more desperate and intolerant the defense of the lie becomes. Like, the resurrection of Jesus never happened. It's impossible. It's a nonsense. It's a myth. But anybody who criticized it during the Middle Ages and Renaissance was persecuted vigorously. You could not challenge the biblical truth of anything. And so for much of our history in the Western world, we had a moral tyranny inflicted on us by the Catholic Church and various Protestant churches.
Epicycles. Protect geocentric the universe, that's because that's what the Bible says.
Yeah, but Urban VIII, the Pope, though, was a bit of an asshole because he was a friend of Galileo's, but because Galileo was a problem child and because the Pope was having external problems with the Holy Roman Emperor, he basically lost his temper and changed his tune. But the point is, the Holocaust has no standing as a historical event. It has standing as a religious concoction. Because the cult of the Holocaust and Israel are tied in with quasi-religious mindset that is impervious to criticism, which is why people are persecuted even for uttering a rational defense of information that contradicts the official version. You can criticize any aspect of history, but if you try to criticize the Holocaust, you're persecuted. And that calls into question, well, what is the Holocaust?
There are some other events that enjoy that sort of dogmatic religious protection, like criticizing Lincoln. What do you say? What do you want? Slaves? No. But you know, you can't have an honest discussion about the Civil War either without being That's called a Southern apologist and pro-slavery or something ridiculous, you know?
Yeah, people don't remember that Abraham Lincoln started the Civil War by resupplying Fort Sumter and deliberately provoking a Southern attack, which the Southerners was it Armstrong, who was the Anderson, General Anderson, who was at the was in South Carolina, fired on Fort Sumter, and that started the war. And I forget. And
Fort Sumter is where they were physically collecting the brand new import export taxes, which is why they're seceding in the first place. The same reason they had a secession movement in the 1820s. And, you know, the people will point to the secession papers and say, oh, well, here and here it mentions slavery. He said, yeah. And the counter proposal to that was the Corbin Amendment, which offered to allow them to keep all their slaves. And everyone seceded anyway, because that was never a primary reason for the war. And they physically fire on the fort collecting the taxes, and they want to act like it's not about the taxes. I get
the Civil War. The Civil War was an economic war. Slavery was important. That is, you know, it was an important consideration. It was important in the minds of the Southerners for their economic well-being. But what was not, which is less well known, is that the Northern states applied prejudicial tariffs and barriers to trade. It kept the Southern economy essentially in perpetual dependency.
Yeah, five Northern states also had slaves themselves, and they enslaved the Chinese after the war, and the whole Nevada Territory had slaves. But that's neither here nor there on the Civil War. I want to drag it back to, you know, Grant did ban Jews from the Treasury and had them kicked out of Kentucky. If we're speculating on cotton and breaking all manner of trade regulations. So apparently there was a group even back then that was causing problems for that. But, you know, I'm not going to stick up for General Grant. That was a nasty war. I mean, you're talking 250,000 people died. Whole cities were burned down. It put the South back generations. Horrible. And that's where, you know, that war is held. That whole final solution came from Tecumseh Sherman, not Adolf Hitler. It was about American Indians and what to do with them.
It's amazing exactly. And I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of Americans were inspirations for Hitler, particularly Henry Ford. Adolf Hitler idolized Henry Ford. He had a picture of him up on his, was in his prison cell when he or was in his office. I don't know. He had a picture of Henry Ford. And he got a lot of his racial theories from Americans. Because Americans were, in many ways, the intellectual progenitors of Hitler's Nazi regime.
Hitler's a teenager. He's watching the Americans put the Apache on train carts and sending them to concentration camps in Florida, where they starved to death. That's where Geronimo ended up. So the whole world was witnessing that. And if you want to talk about a real genocide, a real Holocaust, that it definitely did happen, the genocide of American Indians. But it's never really up there. What kids learn in schools, yes, they know they bombed Japan or whatever, but they don't hear about what happened to Germans post-war. They seem to brush over the 2 million Vietnamese killed, the 1 million Iraqis killed, all the millions of people that have been killed after World War II by the United States. And it's not seen with the same lens of the epitome of evil like the Nazis. If you want to give an example of something evil, just say the Nazis. Not the communists, not the colonialists, it's the Nazis, right? Because we didn't do it.
Well, this is why the Zionist Jews are militantly opposed to using the word Holocaust or genocide to apply to anything that doesn't apply to Jews, because the Jews in the minds of the Zionists are unique sufferers. That the Jew, only Jews have suffered. And this is why Israel is defended as a state of sanctuary for Jews, when in fact Israel was never meant to be a Jewish sanctuary. It's meant to be a Jewish empire. Now, if you look at the borders of Israel, I mean, they never finalized their borders, even when it was illegally proclaimed in 1948. I mean, technically, the partition plan, which was never legal to begin with, because it was never ratified by the Security Council, Truman refused to, because he did not want the United States to be put on record as supporting the genocide of Palestine, which he knew was happening. And he mentioned this in March of 48. He and Warren Austin, his ambassador, said they were going to withdraw their support from the partition plan unless Israel stopped massacring the Arabs. Of course, he didn't have the courage to do that, because Harry Truman was more interested in buying Jewish votes than he was in defending Arab lives.
Hey, see, I got 100,000 Jewish votes and I don't have any Arab.
That's exactly right. You got it. So the upshot is the partition plan was illegal on its face. Nevertheless, let's even grant that it had some merit. It had at least 3 months to run before its term expired. But in between that, Ben-Gurion declares statehood March 15th, Eastern time, and everybody buys into it. And from that point on, the United States, as I say in my book, became midwife to a war crime. Without the United States, particularly the state of New York, there would be no Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Israel is like Frankenstein's monster. He's like the monster that we created because we wanted to do something. But the question becomes, who is more responsible for an atrocity, the person or state that commits it, or the person or state that made it possible in the first place?
I liken him to more like an abusive husband. Like, no matter what Israel does to the United States or how much money and blood it costs the United States, we keep saying, but I know he loves me and coming back to
him. That's a very nice parallel. Very nicely done. Excellent.
The U.S. is like a beaten spouse. I guess you could flip it. Woman, man, whatever. It's like a beaten spouse. It just comes back for more. Oh, the USS Liberty, no problem. I know you were just drunk. You thought it was an Egyptian ship. Oh, you know, September 11th, no big deal. That's okay. We spent $6 trillion, probably $7 trillion now, fighting Israel's wars in the Middle East. Yeah. And the kind of, I don't want to say leftist gatekeeper, because I think some of them are sincere, that think this is a war about American oil. Let's break that down, because that is such a crock. All you have to do is look at oil imports and exports before and after the war.
And well, this is what I did in chapter one of my book.
I'm giving you a softball.
Okay, so this is going to be a home run hit. Okay. No, this is that. Well, thank you for that. If the United States wanted oil, they could have traded for it. They could have done a number of different things. They did not have to bomb Iraq, because to bomb Iraq or bomb any part of the Middle East would have inhibited oil exports. And business does not like war. War is just simply not good for business.
Except for Lockheed.
And the thing is, of the contributions to George W. Bush's 2000 campaign, Exxon Corp contributed $2.3 million, Exxon Mobil $1.4 million, El Paso Corporation $1.1 million, Chevron $1.1 million, and the Koch Industries, our buddies, the Koch guys, about $1.1 million. And this was an oil presidency. So why on earth would you bomb the Middle East? For example, I have a table here.
You already have the oil for food program. You got them by the short hairs.
Oh, like, yeah.
They're not producing more oil after the war than before. And the oil doesn't go to the U.S. after the war. Most of it. But there was one state that got 77% of its oil imports from the Kurdish region in Iraq. And it ain't America.
Nope, that was Israel, wasn't it?
Yes, it is. And I get they're anymore all, as of last year.
But that, they were also the ones who got this so-called ISIS oil, because they were just stealing it during the Syrian incursion. Mm-hmm. What I call Isramerica. I don't use America. I say Isramerica, because it gives the truth. It gives a true picture of the United States as a dependency or a client state of Israel, as part of the greater Zionist empire. But to get back to oil, in 1980, average annual crude oil imports from Iraq were 28,000 barrels a day. This is 1980. 81, it was less than half, was less than 500 barrels a day. Then it was less than 3,000, 10, 12, 46. It didn't pick up again until 1988, which is the end of the Iran-Iraq war. Mm-hmm. 343, 441, it went up. Then at 91, zero. 92, zero. All zeros until 1996 when it's 1,000. 1997, back up to 89. And then it goes back up into the triple digits, 336,000 in 1998. And it hit a high of 795,000 in 2001. So you look at how America, during the 1980s and 1990s, bombed Iraq and lost oil exports, oil imports from Iraq. And Iraq had some of the world's best oil, especially around Basra and in, up at the center, Mosul. So why on earth, if you're an oil business country, would you bomb, especially since Donald Rumsfeld famously shook Saddam Hussein's hand in the early 1980s and allowed him to have chemical weapons?
McFarland's in the background of that too. Iran-Contra fame. They're just sitting there smiling. CIA put Saddam in there in 68 anyway. But yeah, and you know, but with Bush the Lesser, he let the crazies in the basement out, which his father used to refer to the neocons as the crazies.
You've got it. That's chapter four. That's chapter four of my book, Bush versus the Crazies.
You know, his father said, we kicked Vietnam syndrome, and then with the second Iraq war, we made a new syndrome. The most unpopular war about WMDs, they must have known, hey, what are you going to do after the fact when there aren't any WMDs, right?
See, the whole point is it didn't matter.
I know.
I mean, whether they were weapons of mass destruction or not, it didn't matter. America's job was to destroy Iraq for Israel. That's what its job was. It didn't matter how feeble the pretext. America had to commit sacred violence for Israel. And it concocted a horrible excuse, and it did it. It ruined a country, and attempts to explain, well, we made mistakes, we didn't do it right, there were problems with it, misses the point entirely. That was never meant to be successful. It would be nice if it had been from the point of view of the Zionists, but success came second to committing destruction. You can destroy something only to defeat it. But if you destroy something for its own sake, it doesn't matter whether you win or lose. And this is why wars for Israel are so horrible. They're so gratuitous. The attack on Syria poses no threat to anybody. But it has to be destroyed because it has sympathetic ties to Iran. Iran is the target. Syria is merely a stepping stone to get to Iran. So all this violence perpetrated against Idlib, against Damascus, against every other town in Israel, in Syria, this was just a pretext. It was a testing ground. It was a precursor to something else.
And each time there's a lie with the white helmets, and they like to lie about gas. Blaming it, saying they're gassing his own people, no motive. Before Aleppo, they said, this is the new Holocaust. This is the last fill in the blank of Aleppo because it's all going to be gone. And then, of course, Aleppo gets liberated and they're having outdoor Christmas parties within days, you know. They said the same thing about Deir Zor, same thing about Homs, same thing about Dara. They're saying the same thing about Idlib. They said it about Damascus. It doesn't matter, Palmyra. Same, six different times they had this gas propaganda. And it didn't seem to matter what, you know, how quickly it got debunked. It's just like the WMDs. They don't care. The propaganda isn't there, it's not there for intelligent people. It's just there as a pretext for plausible deniability.
It's also there for behavior modification. You're not meant to, it's like the Bible. You check the Bible and it's so contradictory. God creates heaven and earth, the sun. Well, he creates the sun separately at some point. God, man is created contemporaneous with the birds, or he's created after the birds. It's so stupid. The Bible is so contradictory. It is so absurd. Yet anybody who points out the absurdities is deemed to be some sort of a demonist. It's ridiculous.
I'd argue now, though, that it's more sensitive in Western culture to pop the bubble of Holocaustianity than it is. Like, if you went out with a sign that said, "I hate God," some people would yell at you, whatever. If you went out with one that said, "I hate Jews," you'd go to jail. Now, you shouldn't hate Jews, and I don't really care if you hate God or not, because I don't believe in God, but you shouldn't do that, because you know it's going to piss people off. But what's the more protected thing is to say, if you wrote 5,999,999 on a sign in most European countries, you could go to prison.
Yep.
That's amazing.
Because it is. It's the cult of the religion of the Holocaust. There's the new theocracy, but you can't call it that because you've been trained to think of theocracy as being unique to ecclesiastical belief and belief in God. But there's other kinds of theocracy, political theocracy. You elevate a political cult to the status of an absolute truth. That is religion.
Yeah, it's like saying redheads are normal.
Well,
we all know that's a myth.
Okay, my wife's a redhead, so I'll be careful.
Now we know why he's masochistic. No, I use the ginger bashing actually as a tool to show that you can say whatever you want about redheads. They're tough people. They can take it, whatever. I'm not going to get banned on Facebook or anything like that if I pick on redheaded people. If I were to say the same things about actual protected classes, even as obvious jokes, you know, I would get in serious trouble. And so it just shows the double standard there. I could pick on blondes too. I could say make blonde jokes all day and say blonde girls are stupid or something. Mm-hmm. And we all know it's case by case. But they're not the protected class.
Well, this is one thing that, you know, going off slightly off topic just for one second. When you look at classes of people who fight for their rights against an oppressive society, you can support them when they're in the opposition, when they're downtrodden and they're fighting for equality. But the minute they achieve something, then they become part of the system. And the humorless militarism that they evinced when they were outside persists, which is why feminists are wholly humorless. Multiculturalists are humorless. You cannot joke about a feminist because she'll stamp her little feet and squawk and end up becoming a shrill defender of the feminist equality, when in fact equality is merely a way station on route to superiority. There is no women's equality movement. There is no cultural equality movement. It's a load of crap.
I like using the Bill Hicks tactic when you out-evangelize the evangel. He gave this example where I don't know, somebody's putting up anti-abortion posters all over town. Doesn't matter what your view is on abortion or not, but they were putting in pictures of fetuses everywhere. And on their website, over 20 times they said, "This is a child, not a fetus, it's a baby." To them, embryo, fetus, day before birth, all the same things, all baby, in their opinion. So he says, "So you're saying this is a baby, yeah? Right? It's a child, yeah, not okay. a fetus, yes? Okay. It's a naked baby, so why are you pedophile? Why are you putting naked pictures of underage children all over town?" Right? Just got out of his case about it. So I use the Bill Hicks thing for feminists too, where I go into like LGBT. Isn't B binary? When you're saying bisexual, right? Just like the one way to show somebody how ridiculous their cult is to adopt it and get more Puritan than them. It's like what George Carlin said about speeding, you know, someone going slower than you is an idiot, but anybody going faster than you is an asshole. So you go faster than them. And then they realize, like, wow, if you can out-feminize the feminist, they'll see, because you can see this, they can barely have conversations with each other in college campuses. There's so much language policing and, you know, one-upmanship to say that's offensive or whatever, that they can barely talk to each other. It's
crazy. The same thing. Yeah, it's like having, getting back to the Zionists. You can't discuss Jews intelligently, and I'm going to try to finish this within a week. This is a piece about this woman, this hypersensitive, touchy-feely bookstore owner, and this raving bigot named Dennis Fecho, who is so willingly, blindly conflating Zionists with Jew, and he completely refuses even to discuss that there is some difference. And I'm just wondering how it's possible that act like progress against the Zionization of America has been so slow, so ineffectual. And then I look at people who are advocating against Zionization, or trying to liberate America from the Zionist yoke, and these are some of the biggest problems we have.
Mm-hmm. Because a lot of them are also identitarians, and they conflate Zionism with Judaism or Jewish. Yeah. And I'm just, you know, most of the best anti-Zionists I know are Jewish. And it kind of has to be that way, because if you're not Jewish and you criticize it, then you get labeled a Nazi and da da da.
Yeah, let me give you a quote here from Nahum Gold, but I'm going to talk a little bit about Zionist honesty. And this is what Nahum Goldman said in 1977 when he retired as head of the World Jewish Congress. This is what he said. In 30 years, Israel has never presented the Arabs with a single peace plan. She has rejected every settlement plan devised by her friends and by her enemies. She has seemingly no other object than to preserve the status quo while adding territory piece by piece. I condemn the blind support given by American Jewry to Israel, and I call upon President Carter to be more courageous and to prevent the Jewish state's slide into catastrophe. Now, President Carter came out with a book called Israel, Peace, Not Apartheid, and he was vilified as an anti-Semite for speaking about peace. And I think that's something that most people need to focus on, because it was in 1980-82.
Peace is anti-Semitic.
Well, yes, it was Menachem Begin quite literally came up with the term peace offensive. Because with peace, then Israel has no more compulsion to expand. With no more compulsion to expand, there's no more fuel for the dogma that we have to return to the biblical borders of greater Israel, which takes into great swaths of Egypt and what is now Saudi Arabia. So we have to realize that Israel has never legitimately wanted peace. And virtually everything we know or think we know about Israel is a lie. And once we do that, then what happens to the last 70 years of human existence on this planet? What happens to all of the wars of the 60s, 70s, and 80s? Who is responsible for those? Who were the villains and who were the white hats? And we would have to come to the conclusion that is the Western world and Israel are the great aggressors, the great vilifiers of civilization. We are the enemy. We have seen the enemy and he is us. That was a line out of Pogo, a great satirical cartoon written by Walt Kelly. And Pogo was pulled because it got too political. It was censored by the newspapers that carried it.
Hmm.
And so you look at what the Jews have to say. The best sources for Zionism are from Zionists themselves, who can see what they're doing, who know what they're doing. If you've ever seen Game of Thrones, not Game of Thrones, but House of Cards, you look at the corrupt Underwood administration, the people who were committing crime, who were just killing people, setting up false flag attacks, they knew exactly what they were doing. This was not some accident. This was not some recklessness.
I just look at the Clintons instead of looking at a show. Just go to real life.
Well, yeah, I think that there's a lot of similarity between that. I mean, the Clintons are the biggest crime family in America. That and the Bushes. Mm. But the Clintons are the most toxic because they give the illusion of being so virtuous. They have the Clinton Foundation, which is a happy little thing, and it gives money to happy little causes. But the Clinton Foundation is it a money laundering scheme or is a bribery slush fund?
Yeah, Frank Gustra washed money. They didn't even launder their money half the time. They were so arrogant. They got direct bribes from Saudi Arabia, UAE, etc. And, yeah. You know, they didn't care. They thought Hillary was second state. She's going to be president. Don't worry. And then she wasn't president. But when you were speaking of Menachem, I love saying that, by the way, she's not president. When you were talking about Menachem Begin, you know, there are other Jews. Einstein and a long list of prominent Jews of the time wrote a letter to the New York Times.
Yes, he did.
Essentially calling Menachem Begin a terrorist and saying that this is just like the state we fled from. and that it has all the, hallmarks of fascism and of Mussolini and da 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 da. And you really do have to look at the foundation of Israel like organized crime, like Meyer
That's
Lansky
right.
level organized crime. And you actually see that real liaison between the early foundation of the what becomes the Mossad and the OSS, which becomes the CIA, just kind of bled right into organized crime for recruitment.
Well, this is what I said. There's a clip of me on the internet that got hived off some other show, and I said, "This is exactly what I said. Israel is not just a country. It's like international crime. It metastasizes throughout all countries. It cannot be defined by any geographical representation. It's a transnational gangster organization.
It's
I
state
call it the.
sponsorship for illegal activity abroad."
It's a kosher nostra. That's what I call it."
I guess so, yeah. The kosher nostra. I heard that. I think Michael Piper said the same term, maybe. I like your term, Hasbarats, for the Hasbara rats.
That's
I'm
right.
going to Israel that term from you. And I use the word Israel to mean steal. So I'm going
Of
to Israel
course.
Hasbarats from you.
Please do. Matter of fact, I'm very proud of the fact that it has been picked up by other people. And I use this term, a very nice fellow named Gray, I think I forgot his name. The last name was Gray. He was in Baltimore. And he kept using this, and it got picked up, it got recycled over and over, and I felt so happy that I contributed to the lexicon of modern politics. So please feel free to use Hasbarat. And I did this nice picture of Benjamin
See, I
Netanyahu.
can't Israel it if you're giving it to me. I gotta steal it
Okay,
and then
sorry. Okay, don't, okay, don't,
no.
don't, don't use it. Don't use it then. I
Yeah,
will
there
sue
you
you for
go.
copyright infringement.
There's some great videos we made. The first one I did was called "Don't Israel My Juice," like orange juice. And a friend and I did this in Australia. I was drinking some juice, and she comes and just takes it from me. I said, "Hey, did you just Israel my juice?" And she butts me out of the chair. And I go, "Did you just Israel my chair too?" And she turns around and says, "God gave it to me." And I'm like, "Give me back my juice." And she's like, "America." And this big dude comes and hits me with a broom, and then they beat me down. And then later she's on TV, like crying and saying, "He attacked me for no reason. I was just defending myself." Then we did "Don't Israel My Phone," "Don't Israel My Pen." Just it's become a thing online now.
Yeah, but you can't say anything bad about the juice. About that, you got to watch that.
Well, it was juice.
Yeah, I
Juice
know.
with
But
U I C
yeah.
E. No, I think humor is a weapon that we haven't used enough. Like, we try to get in these intellectual discussions, but I see the snarky left getting a lot of their news from Comedy Central and John Oliver, and before that, John Stewart. And I'm thinking we need to do more satire, memes, and songs just to kind of get your foot in the door, and then you can talk seriously about it. So I try
Well,
to dabble in comedy.
if you go to my website, I've got a number of satires, which I had a lot of fun doing because I found at one point I was getting so frustrated trying to write articles about something that was so patently absurd that I felt I had to start mocking this in some artful way. And I've taken on a number of different themes. One of them was Canadian politics, which I do a fair bit about. And I came up with this TV show. I made up my own TV station called WTFN, and I made up my own avatars. And one of the ones I did was I had pet politicians, and I had these lapdog politicians at some boarding kennel, and I had the Zionists train them to be anti-Zionists, and it was quite successful. I really enjoyed doing that. If you go to my website under satires and interviews, you see it's a dog's life for Israel's pet politicians. And this is back when Stephen Harper was the fascist masquerading as a prime minister. But if you want to look at Netanyahu and Harper and their affiliation with Israel, you go to the top ones. This is where I did a kiddie show, and it was called Storytime with Sasha. And I made up my own little picture there. It's a happy little woman, these two children reading. It's ever so sweet and wholesome and just 1950s June Cleaverish. And the questions and the history of the story is told in that the italic type is the story. When the type goes back into Roman type, it's when the teacher, Sasha, which is also my son's name, is talking to the kids. They're interrupting to ask all these interesting questions. And I had so much fun doing this. But they take so much time. I want to do more of these. But please have a look at my satire page at gregfelton.com. There's some, I think, some of my best writing is up there. And I don't always like what I write. But I do enjoy some things I do. And I had so much fun poking fun at the Zios. And I one of the ones I did back in 2011 was... wow, this is before the World Trade Center attack, 3 months before. This was when I merged the Coneheads from Saturday Night Live with the Prime Minister of Canada, because it was the Conehead of Silence. I got that from Get Smart.
You mean the World Trade Center 93 or 2001?
2011. 2001. Sorry, I'm, yeah. 2000. I goofed. Sorry about that. Yeah. So here's Harper. I call people who don't know their history don't know what democratic centralism is. That was a term invented by Vladimir Lenin to talk about the Soviet concept of democracy. It was democratic centralism. And I got this in, and nobody even noticed that this was what Harper was. He was Sovietizing Canada. And I used the Cone of Silence from Get Smart plus the Coneheads from Saturday Night Live. And I had so much fun with that. So if you want satire, please have a look at my website, see what you think, and please, you can Israel them if you wish.
There you go. Yeah, but just I'll send you some things. My friends have made some songs up too, like Last Dance with John McCain. You got to hear it. He's still
Insane
dead.
McCain?
The Last Dance with John McCain.
Yeah, I call him Insane.
Mary Jane. I called him a lot of words. I called him Crazy Train McCain, McNasty. I Israeled McNasty from Doug Valentine. He wrote about McNasty because his father and McCain's father, I think, had some overlap. Didn't like each other. But yeah, McNasty, Crazy Train McCain.
I imagine Don McCain standing at the edge of a cliff, standing in a very proud, bold, Superman-ish sort of way, but a big eye on his chest for Insane. And I just imagine him looking like that.
I'm trying to nominate a Nobel Peace Prize for the tumor.
Okay.
It went on a brave suicide mission to kill John McCain, so it killed a warmongering lunatic. Therefore, it should. Although I guess we only really give the Nobel Peace Prize to warmongering lunatics like Henry Kissinger or Obama. So.
Yeah, Obama was truly astounding. It was just truly appalling. He did nothing. He gave a speech that was feeble and that, oh, let's give him the award. Let's not give it to somebody more deserving. I'd love to see Vladimir Putin get the Nobel Peace Prize for preventing World War III in Syria.
You know, that guy also, I don't think anybody can troll at the level of President Trump. But if there's a second place is Vladimir Putin. And something he recently did in China, people call Xi Jinping Pooh Bear. He looks like Winnie the Pooh. They banned the movie Winnie the Pooh in China. That's how insulted he was. Yeah. Oh dear. Exactly. Yeah. Nice. Oh, Baba.
Oh dear.
But
ballsy.
Vladimir Putin met Xi Jinping and gave him a gift, and it was a jar of honey. Oh, what are you gonna do? Invade Russia? You know, it's like he gave him a jar of honey. That is hilarious.
That's great.
But I mean, Trump like is the hands down the most entertaining president. tweeting, calling Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas, and some of the stuff he says, I'm like, no, did he? And then I'm like, did he? You know, because a lot of his BS, you know, that people just say he said, but sometimes, you know, Little Rocket Man, that was a real thing that happened.
Yeah. The problem is Trump is the least presidential president we've ever had. But he doesn't really understand his job. I think he scares me a little bit because going on Twitter to act like some intemperate little teenager is not what cabinet government is supposed to institute in presidents. You're not supposed to do this. You have to consult with people before you run off at the mouth and do something stupid.
Do you? I think that's what gets you elected.
Yeah. The thing is, the great thing about Trump was that he was not part of the deep state establishment. He was not part of the Zionist infrastructure. But what worries me is that he doesn't know his job. He does stupid things like going on Twitter, which just embarrasses the United States and makes him look stupid. It makes him unpredictable. I mean, he could start a massive meltdown of an economic meltdown, or he could start a war just by going on Twitter and doing something stupid.
Do you think that's why his threats on North Korea were like, I don't know, he might do it, and that's how he got peace? Kind of accidentally.
I don't think he has the brains for that. I really don't.
No,
I
I'm think just joking. Like, they're like, he might hit the button. Like, let's we don't want to work with this guy. And look who's under him, John Bolton, and anything, you know, it could get worse. So
yeah. Oh, yeah, actually, this is why his impeachment insurance is
Pence, who's a neocon.
Yeah, Pence. Yeah. Yeah, he's the impeachment insurance. He is a psychopath.
He's the new Dick Cheney.
He is the new Dick Cheney. He certainly is. I don't know
that's a good point. I want to bring before you. You've said this before. I heard you say it. I think you were talking to a public library or something, and you were saying Dick Cheney twice, Rumsfeld twice, Condoleezza Rice at least one time had all admitted and articulated that no, we can't go kill Saddam Hussein. It would create a quagmire, and explained exactly what would go down with the, you know, the sectarian infighting and all that. But post 9/11, when we go into bizarro world, as Justin Raimondo likes to say, then the neocons had their way. They all did everything for the Zionists, knowing that it was against American interests, knowing what it was going to actually create, and did it anyway.
That was this goes back to April 1991, when Dick Cheney was George Bush's Secretary of Defense. He gave this speech where he defended Bush's decision to pull out of Iraq, not to go to Baghdad, not to kill Saddam Hussein. And he gave a whole bunch of reasons why it was a good decision and why going into Iraq would have set the United States up at a quagmire from which they would never recover. He was bang on correct. He becomes vice president.
It was 91, not 81. It was
91, that's right. And then he becomes Reichschancellor of the new state of under Bush, and he just completely flips. And nobody remembers what he said in 1991. No one holds him accountable to that.
There's a video of him in 94 reiterating it. I mean, and it wasn't just one time. They knew what the Oded Yanan's plan was. They knew what the Israelis wanted. They said this would be such a disaster for the United States. Like you said, it makes you not get oil. It's going to make us hated in the entire region and never trusted again. Didn't matter. And they starved all those kids to death. Hundreds of thousands. There's a Holocaust for you. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis died of starvation intentionally for Israeli pressure.
And Madeleine Albright said it was a good thing. I got this satirical ad I designed that for Alan Dershowitz, where I call him Dershbag. And it was for a feminine hygiene product. And Madeleine Albright, who was a horrible piece of work, she said she had no trouble sacrificing 500,000 Iraqi children. It was unfortunate, but I felt it was the right decision.
That was in 97, and so they had many more years of sanctions after that 500,000 mark. I mean, it continued, and it got exponentially worse as you got up to 2002. Yeah. So, I mean, people quote 500,000 deaths, mostly children. I go, yeah, in the 90s. Now I add 6 more years. I mean, it was so terrible.
How can you explain this other than the United States is no longer in control of its own foreign policy?
I think how can you explain? Buchanan was right.
Yeah. Its Congress is Israeli-occupied territory.
Mm-hmm. So is the president.
When you have more than 70% of senators at a drop of a at a snap of a finger will write a protest letter to the president defending Israel. You have little sock puppets and ass-kissing idiots like Lindsey Graham, who is toxic little man, who is not even he's barely American. He is an Israeli stooge.
And I think he may be in the McGreevy situation, the way that Kushner had McGreevy's closet homosexuality under wraps and videotaped. Lindsey just needs to come on out.
Okay.
That guy.
He has to move out of his. He's got to move out of his house.
I mean, he's an evangel anyway, so he's ideologically in line. But I don't know. I see him as in a McGreevy situation. You know, he's like he's normal. I mean, if you look at the U.S. Senate, it's sometimes they vote 100-0. You know, yeah. Or you know, at least no votes. Some might abstain, but they'll vote 100-0 in favor of Israeli resolutions. There's some of them that don't even mean anything, like just vague. We're going to stand by Israel for this, and nobody. Sometimes a Rand Paul or you know, a token two or three will go against it, and then in Congress you have like what Thomas Massey, Walter Jones, maybe a couple others that will break party, but. They all what about, line for Israel.
But what about the fact that is that incoming congressmen have to sign a loyalty oath to Israel?
Yeah. Well, they were doing that for hurricane victims. You can't get insurance money unless you swear not to boycott Israel.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Dixon, Texas rejected that, but they just tried that in the Carolinas. Like, what in the world does loyalty to Israel have to do with getting hurricane relief funds?
Nothing, absolutely nothing. But this is how Israel is such a totalitarian octopus. It imposes itself so thoroughly on American culture that the Constitution no longer means anything. It's a scofflaw. We are now wholly owned by Israel. We are essentially a client state of Israel.
See, I think they've overplayed their hand. I think
they
those
have.
Kind of hubris acts are, they win themselves to death. And I think they're riding the tiger, as the Chinese like to say. Like, you can't get off because you'll get eaten, right? So they're going down.
They are, but the only question is how fast. And this is one thing. You notice the United States now is alienating so many countries that were formerly friendly. The United States, I was reading just yesterday where Russia, China, and Europe are going to get around the new round of sanctions against Iran. They're going to isolate the United States. The U.S. is losing influence all over the world because it is so clearly in the pocket of Israel that whatever it's doing has no benefit for the United States. And we're going to see a realignment of politics over the next 10 years. Russia and China are going to be the leaders of the world. And whether that's good or bad is neither here nor there. It's just going to be the way it is. Israel's little sock puppet is just showing too many signs of wear. It can't go on like this.
And it's
Canada
really
is even worse.
The whole world
Canada,
sees what they're doing.
Yeah, Canada is also a disgraceful codependent here.
I mean, between countries that matter, all they have left is the U.S. I'm just kidding. Sorry.
Well, no,
Canada
don't
is just as bad, though. I mean, Canada gets bullied by the United States as much as it gets bullied by Israel.
That's right. We are essentially in a no-win position, but we have no stomach. We have no leader that can even articulate an intelligent speech that can defend itself. This country we have been run by idiots for so long. Like in this country, to tell you how bad it is, Trudeau is essentially a corporate stooge, an oil industry stooge. The party, the Conservative Party, and I use the term loosely, is run by a Zionist schmuck named Andrew Scheer, who was worse than Trudeau could ever possibly be. If you've ever seen the show The Good Wife, you get a sense of what kind of person this man is if you go to the third to last season about some of the Republicans running for office. The leader of the new Democratic Party, the left of center party, is a Sikh, Jasmeet Singh, who is probably a decent guy, but he's a rookie. And the party itself is so full of its identity politics sanctimony that it's never even thought about governing intelligently. The Green Party is still too small to be considered viable. And the Quebec Separatist Party is essentially wandering the wilderness looking for a reason to exist. So we have no real choice of government. We have nothing up here. The best we can hope for is a minority government, but the two right-of-center business parties are going to collaborate, and we're basically going to be screwed again. And we are in such serious trouble in this country, you have no idea. we have provinces that are fighting for their own constitutional rights, and they're being bullied by a central government that would rather pay $4.5 billion for a useless pipeline to Kinder Morgan of Texas for some horrible profit margin, rather than defend the coastline from tankers.
It's going to be Sunnyvale from coast to coast.
It's going to be. We're going to have. I don't know if it'll happen, but I can see some sort of quasi civil war breaking out over this. I can see a violent standoffs.
Really?
Yeah, I can see it.
Canadian violence.
Canadians have a history of an international reputation for being tolerant and very easygoing, but we were some of the best soldiers for the British forces in World War II, World War I. We were some of the toughest, especially the people from Quebec, the 22nd Regiment. Anyway,
you get George St. Pierre for Prime Minister. He's got enough money. The day I'm waiting for the circus to go on full. Like, I think we're going to have a lot more celebrity presidents and congressmen. I mean, we've had our Arnold Schwarzeneggers, Jesse Ventura, Kane just got elected mayor in Tennessee, in Knoxville. Although he legit knows what he's doing. But that I think people voted for these people because they're famous.
They also
had a reality show. Reagan was an actor. Like, they don't know. Like, if more actors would run, a lot of them could win. If you're not a complete idiot and you're famous, I think you could win a lot of races.
Yeah, but Trump is a complete idiot, and he did win.
Yeah, he's a billionaire idiot, so it's different.
Yeah, but actually, no, he didn't win. Clinton lost.
Right.
That's a big difference. There's a big difference.
She was more than capable of losing by herself.
Yeah, she did.
I mean, I would have voted for roadkill over Hillary Clinton.
I think a lot of people did, and actually, that's how Trump got elected.
Uh-huh.
But what's interesting is that this whole Russian hacking scandal came out of the Democratic National Committee to provide rhetorical cover for Clinton because she was going to get her ass kicked, and they needed to find someone to blame. So they blamed this outsider, this Russian hacking scandal, which was never even remotely credible to begin with.
My favorite, though, of all the BS, like Russia did it stuff, was blaming the rebellion in Benghazi on an internet film on YouTube that made fun of Muhammad. That was their official thing.
Oh, God. Well, that was Clinton, too. You know, Clinton had she was up to her eyes in blood in Libya.
You know, you've got a lot of yes men around you when no one tells you no at an idea that's stupid, you know.
Yeah.
And that's why I think their hubris is their downfall. They're losing in Syria. Idlib has no chance of defeating Russia and Syria. So ISIS is going to be defeated. Israel is not going to be able to annex land in Syria the way that they did in Iraq. And yet they're not going to let it go because that's their personality. They're trying to go in now with their own jets, and they're going to end up getting shot down here soon. They already lost one F-16.
Yeah. No, you're quite right. As you say, they cannot stop. Riding the tiger is a good metaphor because it also explains why drug addicts can't stop riding the tiger. Once they stop, then what happens? They're addicted to violence. They're addicted to killing. If you ain't killing, you ain't happy. And Israel cannot stop killing because it is a parasitic, metastasizing cancer that has to kill healthy cells or healthy civilizations to perpetuate itself in existence.
Mm-hmm. And the security apparatus is like 60% of their economy. So if they don't have snipers shooting children in the face, what are they going to do? Fight a real enemy that can fire back? They can't do that either.
Israel is a failed state. If you look at it strictly speaking as a country that it has no economy to speak of, that is dependent on foreign American aid, it's very little different from South Vietnam, because the Ngo Dinh Diem government, up until he was overthrown, had 80% of its economy subsidized by the United States. It had no independence as a state, and Israel has no independence as a state. It's a parasitic entity that feeds off of its host, which is why the title of my book, which I agonized over for so long, I think is probably the best way to put it. the host, which is the United States, and the parasite, which is Israel. This is precisely why Israel will never become a legitimate state.
I'm so glad you chose that. I was having dinner one time in L.A. and with my friends, and we were liking Israel to cancer, to AIDS, and I was like, it's a parasite, and gave my analogy and arguments, and pretty much along what you've said as well. It is a parasite. And people have tried to twist that and saying, are you saying Jews are parasites? No.
Of course.
The lobby is the parasite, and the government is the host. Parasites flock to the biggest host. And you can think of government, like, I think failed state's redundant. Like, state is failing. State failed. But you have a giant ATM machine for corporate conglomerates. That's what government is. It soaks up taxes and borrows money from the Fed or whatever central bank and awards it to its buddies. Cronyism. And you ain't in this club, you know, but at least you could have some overlapping interests for your piece of dirt. And with America, the oil policy on up through the 70s, when they broke up OPEC, that's gone. Our entire Middle East policy is at the behest of Zionists who simply bribe their way into getting what they want.
Yep.
And the media is complicit in it. I mean, the press is always complicit for the IMC, but MIC, but it's the same thing. They can't criticize the policy because of this, you know, grievance industry of, hey, if you do that, we're going to accuse you of anti-Semitism. And boy, that's all it takes to buckle them. All it takes to buckle the left is some accusation of an ism. And we definitely have a leftist media, I mean, Hollywood as well.
Well, I wouldn't say we have a leftist media. I think that's a little bit misleading insofar as the press is so pro-business, anti-labor, that it is corporate. I would say corporate is a better way to put it. It is perhaps leftist in some sort of sociological sense, where they might support abortion, they might support medical care. But I wouldn't call it left wing. I would think that it's a bit more complicated.
They're pro war. I mean, it's the Democrats who started World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam. They are the traditional big government, big war party.
That's the war. You're right. It's the war party. It's the natural governing party of Israel. That's what I call it too.
The Kudik politics.
Exactly.
But your audio is getting fuzzy. And I want to thank you for your time. I'll have you back on. We can talk about this for hours. We went over more than the time I thought, but I really enjoyed talking to you. I hope everybody gets the book. The link to both books is below, and a link to Greg's sites below too. And go check out his satire and go through that. It's sometimes as good just for stress relief, you know, to see a satirical version of these things. And then, of course, you want to get the newest book, the third edition for The Host and the Parasite.
Parasite.com. It's got its own website.
It's got its own. Well, that's all going to be linked below this talk if you're watching on YouTube. All the links are below if you're watching on ANC Report. If you're seeing a copy of this video, please go grab the links, stick it in the description. And if you're the guy copying this video, if you're going to Israel the video, you got to Israel the links too, guys.
Israel is real as it gets.
Anyway, thanks for having me. We must talk about the 1967 war and how that was essentially an act of aggression from Egypt.
Oh, we'll definitely talk about 1967. I have a good interview with Jeff Gates about that as well. And so that's a great topic for next time. Just talking about 1967. And the myths around that, because they always skip 48 and 56 and go right to the Six-Day War. And Israel started that war, and we will prove it. Obviously, they admit they started it, but the excuse is, they're building up on our border. That is all BS. It's nothing but lies, and we're going to break that down next time Greg comes on.